How can a song about what was happening 80 years ago still feel relevant?
I think what Cole Porter says is you better accept the fact that anything's going to go, because that's what America's about.
Today in Studio 360, we'll look at what makes Cole Porter's taboo-embracing anthem Anything Goes an American icon. And I'll speak with the writer-director Jill Soloway, who's embracing taboo with her new movie Afternoon Delight. It's about a yuppie mom who brings a stripper home to live with her family. And it was inspired by actual events.
While I was getting my lap dance, I started to be overcome with the idea that the stripper was in love with me and that she needed me to get her out of there.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and we've also got Haim, the hot new band of the season, all ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The three sisters that make up the Los Angeles band Haim have been playing music together since they were old enough to hold instruments. And after all that time together, they can pretty much read each other's minds.
There's definitely a weird sisterly ESP that we have.
Sometimes we finish each other's sandwiches.
Weird.
Alana, Danielle, and Esty Haim will perform live in the studio later this hour. But first,
it is a great pleasure for us to present to you this morning a new work by Vincent van Gogh.
There are not many artists, maybe none, with quite the star power of Vincent van Gogh. Partly it's his story, the mad genius, uncelebrated in his day, who had the ultimate afterlife reversal of fortune. And partly it's the one-of-a-kind, ahead-of-its-time, modern but lovable work he left behind when he died in 1890, a body of work we all know really well. Which is why it was so strange when this week the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam announced that there is a new Van Gogh painting, one that for 80 years was thought to be a fake, stowed away in a disappointed collector's attic. Tayo Maidendorp is one of the Van Gogh Museum experts who decided that it was the real thing after all, and he joins me now. Tayo, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Why did the owners of this painting, which was, you know, had been non-authenticated for so many years, bring it back a couple of years ago?
Well, the reason was is that they got some new information. It's a landscape painting, and you see a ruin in the top left corner.
Right.
That's the ruin of an abbey of Montmajour. But the location was not recognized. Somebody recognized on the painting the area, and it was somebody who came from the south of France, and he said, but that's the Montmajour, that's where Van Gogh worked there, so this, maybe it is a Van Gogh. And that's what made them decide to go back to the museum with this information, and that's when we proceeded. And then, the past 20 years, there's so much new work, art historical, scientific work been done on Van Gogh.
So these owners must be very grateful to you. They brought in what was essentially a worthless picture, and now it's a painting worth tens of millions of dollars.
Well, probably, but we don't say anything about the owners. It's a deal we've made with them that they want to remain anonymous and of what they think and what they do, and that's something that we respect.
So talk to me about the techniques that have been developed in the last few years that enabled you to say with certainty now that it is indeed what it is.
Well, it's a combination of things, of course. First, of course, what we do is then compare it to other paintings from this period. You look at the family collection, because we know, of course, that we found a quote from his letters in which he says that he's going to send some pictures to his brother, Theo, in Paris. And we also can single this one out as the one that was sent in mid-August to his brother. When Vincent died in 1890, an inventory was made up, and this inventory has got numbers as well. Looking at the inventory, and we looked at the number 180, there was a question mark because we didn't have a painting that fitted that description. And when we turned to the back of the picture, there was a number 180 on the back.
That sounds like it made your job easy.
Well, in a sense, made it easy. But even then, you have to be very careful. It can be a coincidence, although, of course, it is wonderful to find something like that. And we could trace it further back. We recognized it from a critic who saw an exhibition in 1892 in Amsterdam. We found a description in a newspaper clipping And then again, we found a new exhibition in 1901 where it was hanging in Utrecht, also in the Netherlands. And of course, well, the nicest fitting provenance is always the one that you can almost trace back to the easel of the painter. And that's what happened in this case.
Well, it's interesting. It sounds as though it was maybe more the letters, the inventory, the newspaper accounts of exhibitions that led you to reappraise this as a Van Gogh, more than it was the technical.
Well, that's the first thing. But then, of course, you want to be sure about everything. And that's when also the technical examination gets in. And we want to know, of course, which colors were used. And there were some new developments in that respect. One of them is that you can do these detections of the whole palette far more easily with X-ray fluorescent spectrometry. And that fitted the whole palette, you might say, what we know Van Gogh was using at the time. So, and then all of a sudden you might say that all these pieces of a puzzle make, in the end, this description of the whole picture.
Right. And looking at the picture, which, as you say, is a landscape with this ruin in the background, I mean, now that we know what it is, it has the familiar Van Gogh brushstrokes and swirliness. But as a picture, it seems relatively conventional without the vivid colors that we know Van Gogh by. Is that one of the reasons it wasn't considered authentic, just because this is too drab?
Well, conventional, I wouldn't say conventional. It is, what we have to keep in mind is that it is a sunset.
Right.
He chose a very large format as a size to paint on. He didn't have much time, so he had to work quickly. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there was a hard wind blowing. It was a day before the Mistral broke out, which is this very severe wind in the south of France. And it is one of the first pictures, which is with this enormous impastos. But that's something that only starts in this period, in Arles, in the summer of 1888, when he goes towards his most famous works that he's doing at the time. Well, one of them is, of course, is The Harvest, which he painted only a couple of weeks before. And only a month after this, he starts with his sunflowers.
And given that it is in that pivotal time period of his work, does it change the art historical story at all, or is it just a puzzle that confirms what we already think?
It's a bit of both. It's like we found a missing link that we didn't know was missing. It is a painting which puts into perspective what he was doing before this picture and what he was doing afterwards.
Yet now that you know it's there and you've identified it, well, it's obvious.
Yes, but it's always what you can tell afterwards.
Yeah.
It's never that obvious, of course, at first.
Right.
And, of course, now when we put it on show in the museum in a couple of weeks, is to look at it, and we'll put it into context with other works as well. And they can tell for themselves, obviously, it's a Van Gogh.
Tayo Maidendorp, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Tayo Maidendorp is a researcher at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. There are sitcoms, there are dramas, and then there are the great TV shows that careen back and forth, making you laugh and cry and think and cringe. Shows like 6 Feet Under and The United States of Tara, both shows written in part by Jill Soloway. Soloway has now written and directed her first feature film. It's about how to be an adult, and I should say, if you're listening with little kids, this will be an adult conversation. Soloway's movie is called Afternoon Delight. It's the story of an affluent stay-at-home mother in Los Angeles who befriends a stripper and brings her home, and not just for the night.
Anyway, who would have thunk it? Ran into McKenna.
I don't know who McKenna is.
Oh, she, she's the dancer. She's the dancer that gave me that private thingy when we were there.
You mean the stripper?
Okay, sure. The stripper is in the maid's room.
The stripper's in the maid's room?
Yeah.
How did the stripper get in the maid's room?
And she's not just a stripper. She also has sex for money. Afternoon Delight won Soloway the Best Dramatic Directing Award at the Sundance Film Festival this year. And she is here with me now, Jill Soloway. Welcome to Studio 360.
Glad to be here.
The premise for Afternoon Delight, did this occur to you full-blown as a fictional conceit, or was there some real-life inspiration?
Well, there were a few steps. I remember like about 5 or so years ago, I went, you know, in one of those sort of ironic trips to a strip club with some friends. And while I was getting my lap dance, I started to, you know, be overcome with the idea that the stripper was in love with me and that she needed me to get her out of there.
Huh.
And thus a movie was conceived. No, I mean, that time I didn't really think about the movie. I just started to think comedically over the years of how funny it is that I think a friend of mine said, like, this movie is about the fact that, you know, men know that you don't bring strippers home, but women don't. And I think I was struck by the intimacy and the emotional connection that happens during a private dance, that, you know, you close that curtain and the girl dances, and it's not really just about getting turned on. It's about feeling like for those 3 minutes, there are only the two of you in the world and that you are the special customer. You know, that's part of, you know, the magic of what a great sex worker can do is, you know, not say, I'm just dancing for the money.
Yeah.
I'm just having sex with you because you're paying me. But they are able to imitate a feeling of love. And I just thought how funny it would be if, like, a mom came in there and she got really confused about what that love feeling was.
Yeah.
You know, is this girl my daughter? Is she my sister? Or, you know, am I her customer?
You are a sex worker.
Yes, I am a sex worker.
And you have been working in sex for how long?
2 years. I started when I was 20.
You told me you were 19.
Oh, yeah, I tell all my customers that. It's like a barely legal thing. It turns them on.
What does it mean to see other people as customers?
Doctors have customers. Psychiatrists have customers. People that work in stores have customers. A lot of people in this world have customers.
What if those customers had wives?
So?
You didn't feel a sense of responsibility? Or
no.
Sisterliness?
No.
That is Juno Temple and Catherine Hanna in Afternoon Delight, and I'm speaking with the director, Jill Soloway. In a speech you gave a few years ago, you talked at length about the movies you wished existed and the things you wanted to see in those movies. Is Afternoon Delight that Jill Soloway dream movie?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I've been emotionally and intellectually trying to uncover this notion of a heroine's journey,
mm-hmm.
what it would feel like to have a movie that's about what it feels like to be a woman. You know, in most movies, even movies that are about women, there's usually a guy somewhere, if he's not the director, then he might be the producer, he might be the writer, who's just putting a little bit in there about how he likes women to be and act and, you know, behave.
Yeah.
And that can either be, you know, 1% or 90%. But when you're a woman and you're in the audience, you can feel it because you have to give up certain things to be able to relate to a protagonist. We're used to being able to relate to a male protagonist. That's just natural. And then we're also used to being, you know, saying, well, women would never do that. But because this woman is on a huge, you know, giant screen in a multiplex, she has to act a certain way, the way that a male-approved female would act. And so, yes, it was totally my dream to say, this is a movie about what it means to really be a woman.
Well, there's a particular scene in this film that, as a man, I felt like, whoa, I'm really getting to see women being women alone. It's the scene where the heroine and her friends have their regular women and wine night, and they get sloshed and start talking about whatever they want to talk about.
I have a very attractive husband. I think we can all get on board for that.
Yes.
But sometimes a little picturing a little, what's his name? Fassbender.
Fassbender!
Fassbender.
That Jodie Foster movie on the pool table.
Oh, my God.
The Accused. That was, was that a pool table or a jukebox?
They're talking about the actor Michael Fassbender and about the movie The Accused, in which Jodie Foster is being viciously gang raped on that pool table, and they're talking about getting off on that. If a man had dared to write or direct this scene in your movie, there'd be massive protests, right?
Demonstrations in the streets. Yeah, I actually want to give credit to an amazing joke writer. Her name is Claudia Lano, and she wrote that joke. I'm so excited to even have the conversation about rape jokes. I mean, I just feel like, of course, rape isn't funny. I like to say, I will stop writing rape jokes when men stop raping. But until women are able to live their lives without the fear of rape, which we've been taught to fear since we were small, so we have to be able to make jokes about it so that we can deal with the fact that this is out there all the time. Simply claiming desire, simply claiming the interest in sex allows you to be ruined as a character on any kind of a television show. Prostitutes are sort of only seen on television as corpses on CSI. These questions of rape, consent, are sex workers people too? You know, what is actual consent? What did consent look like for us in college? These unspeakable things. Who thinks about what their aborted children would be like? Unspeakable in the current feminist consciousness. Who gets turned on by the rape scene in The Accused? Unspeakable. To me, as a feminist, you know, using comedy and drama and art to set the stage for these conversations about these questions feels like just a huge privilege and really part of my vision for myself as an artist.
In Afternoon Delight, for such a racy, edgy premise, the moral of the story, I won't give away the ending, but it is surprisingly conventional. It celebrates bourgeois norms of marriage and commitment. Did you start with that idea in mind?
I was a little embarrassed when I watched the whole movie. When I was like, this is a commercial for Family First. It feels very much like, you know what, the deepest joy in life can be found in the bonds of monogamy. It's a little embarrassing in this very radical modern day and age to have made a movie that's about love and marriage, or love in marriage,
right.
Sex in marriage. I definitely knew from the beginning that I didn't want McKenna to ruin everything.
McKenna being the sex worker.
Yeah, I didn't want this to be a story about the sex worker coming into the house and exploding a marriage. I knew that I wanted McKenna to get out alive and that I wanted the marriage to stand. Those two things I knew. How close we were going to get to McKenna getting out alive and to the marriage standing, I wasn't sure about.
The characters, the female characters in this movie, I had a thought as I was watching them. Oh, these are like the people on Girls in 15 or 20 years. Were you conscious of any resemblance to Lena Dunham's people down the line?
Yeah. I mean, when Girls first came out, I had all these people come up to me sort of smiling like, so? Everybody told me that she reminded them of me, and it was really weird. And, you know, I saw Tiny Furniture and loved it and loved her and did feel like we were kindred spirits. You know, I feel like she did something. She really helped me because I had sort of gone into meetings describing, I want to do a show about a woman who, you know, she's not like Carrie Bradshaw. She's not perfect. She's not skinny. She's not obsessed with shoes. She's just a person. She's just a person like Seth Rogen or Woody Allen or Albert Brooks, and she's at the center. Nobody's looking at her. She gets to look. And I would pitch that in room after room after room, and people would nod. And as you know, that show never got on the air.
Yeah.
I think I saw that Nicole Hall of Center said the same thing. Girls is the show she wishes she had created. I think we all wish we had created it.
You're just too old to have been allowed to create it, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, one person said to me, well, she couldn't have made Girls without you. I was like, thank you. You know, writing Claire Fisher allowed her to make Girls. I was like, I needed that. The truth is, when I did start watching Girls, I was pretty insanely jealous. Like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
You know, how did she pull this off without me? And then I heard something that she was doing a podcast, and she said something that her father said about this notion about, you know, sort of other women and competition and how maybe the rest of us would feel like Lena had done something now and what was left for the rest of us to do. Okay, she did Girls, now what? And she said that her dad, who's an artist named Carol Dunham, said, a rising tide lifts all boats. And I sort of took my jealousy and allowed that idea, a rising tide lifts all boats, to, you know, just become real for me. I asked myself, okay, what's my girls? You know, what can I do? What do I know? I know about marriage. I know about sex. I know about motherhood. I challenged myself to get as real with my voice as she got with hers. I believe that the thing that Lena has that all of us are most jealous of is that she was raised by artists. And so she never had to get over that time where she had to prove to herself, it's okay for me to listen to my voice. It's okay for me to want to see my voice. She grew up knowing that. She grew up knowing that the rest of us had to find it. The rest of us had to fight for it. It took me, you know, all of these years and watching quite a few episodes of Girls and Louie to give myself the permission to do it.
Thinking of Lena Dunham in Girls and Louis C.K. and Louie and Woody Allen and Albert Brooks, these great comic auteurs who also starred in the things they made, is that something you would like to do as well?
It's funny. In the pilot that I'm getting ready to shoot right now, there's a part for a woman who's more or less my age, and we've been casting it. And I did say, you know what, I'm going to go on tape too. I'm going to read. I'm going to see what it's like to see myself saying these lines. And I actually really liked myself as an actor, but I don't know if anybody else did. I mean, I feel like I got to a point with the possibility of me playing this role in my pilot where if I really wanted to, I could have pushed and said, you know, I'm going to act in this too, and mm-hmm. I'm going to play the older sister. And I just thought, you know what, I don't need it that much. I've actually found unbelievable actresses who are doing it better than I ever could have dreamed, and I'm super excited to be able to, like, just, you know, allow myself to write, direct, and produce right now, and I guess I'll worry about performing later.
That makes sense. Jill Soloway, congratulations. Thanks for making this movie, and thanks for being here today.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
Afternoon Delight is the movie's name, and it is out now.
Skyrockets in flight. Afternoon delight. Afternoon delight.
Coming up.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Cole Porter's classic Anything Goes covered lots of taboos, a lot of them still relevant, but it was 1934, so we've given the song an update.
When dames as dim as Kim Kardashian triumph by acting trashy in tawdry shows, anything goes. The smut you can get today on the net today.
We dare to mess around with an American icon. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Long before Miley Cyrus decided to twerk all over the MTV Video Music Awards, Cole Porter perfectly captured the spirit of bawdy behavior and debauchery a la America.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows.
We're always shocked until we're not anymore, until the next shocker comes around. But in the end, pretty much anything goes. As you might know, Anything Goes was the title song of a Cole Porter musical set aboard an ocean liner. The play is a little worse for wear, but the song keeps finding new fans thanks to covers, from Frank Sinatra to the cast of Glee. As part of our series on American icons, Studio 360's Eric Malinsky traces the history of a tune that celebrates breaking taboos.
You know, it's funny, the first time I heard Anything Goes was as a kid seeing Indiana Jones at the Temple of Doom.
Oh, in Chinese. And high Mandarin.
Yes. Do you remember that?
Apparently I do.
Will Friedwald is a pop music historian.
I'm sure there are people that have done it with a Latin rhythm. You could do it as a bossa nova. You could take it to Warsaw and do it as a polka. It would work perfectly as a polka. To me, that's the definition of a standard in the songbook, is that it's written to be done in all these different ways. You don't get to do that with a Beatles song or a Joni Mitchell song. Or if you do, usually the results are so vacacta, you know, why would you bother?
Vacacta is not a word that Cole Porter would have used. Unlike everyone else on Broadway, he didn't speak Yiddish.
99% of everybody else was Jewish and first or second generation immigrant and lived in New York.
Lawrence Maslin teaches theater at New York University.
Cole Porter seemed to have been airlifted from this mythical place called Peru, Indiana, with impeccable breeding and a stock portfolio worth several million dollars back in the 19-teens.
So not exactly a starving artist. When his first Broadway show flopped in 1919, he moved to Paris and threw parties for years. That's actually how Porter established his great reputation as a songwriter, making up hilarious songs to play for his famous friends.
Richard Rodgers in 1926 made a pilgrimage to hear Cole Porter's songs because he couldn't imagine that they were as wonderful as he had heard, and they were even better.
They were also filled with double entendres. Porter waits until the end of the first verse of Let's Do It to reveal that doing it is just falling in love.
If you thought it was dirty in Cole Porter, you'd be right.
Paris in the 20s was perfect for Porter. Everyone knew he was gay, including his wife. Then the Depression hit, fascism was on the rise, the expat started going home. When Porter got back, he felt like Rip Van Winkle. He missed the roaring 20s, and when he was gone, America had gotten sexy. Historian Julia Foulkes says, everyone was buzzing about this, quote, new American woman.
All of a sudden, she had short hair, she had a much shorter hemline, she was dancing, and she was smoking and drinking and going out with men, perhaps a number of men.
They were also voting and going to college and getting jobs in brand new skyscrapers. In the Depression, there were even laws passed to prevent women from taking work away from men.
And all of a sudden, you have that newfound freedom of women looking more threatening.
But the big change in social mores came from Detroit.
Prior to the 20th century, courtship would take place under the guise and under the eyes of your family. So you'd be sitting on the porch, swinging perhaps with your intended. And it was all very scripted in many ways and very watched. But cars came around and it allowed for private space. And a lot more things could occur in the backseat of a car than on a park bench or a dance hall.
So Porter's observing all these changes while he's plotting his comeback. He has a couple of modest hits, and then in 1934, he strikes gold with Anything Goes. The show is full of madcap shenanigans on a cruise ship. The plot is vapid, but the songs are catchy. It was a perfect tonic for the Depression. Porter even cut a demo that played on the radio.
Times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got the shock. When they landed on Plymouth Rock, if today any shock they should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock would land on them. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes.
Now, we usually think of the 60s as the big era of social change, but the 1920s were a shocker. Porter is writing about lesbian fashionistas, respectable writers using four-letter words, and couples going to nudist parties. There are also jokes about Rockefeller, Roosevelt, and scandals from the 30s that no one remembers now. But we're still humming the tune. What makes the song endure, according to Lawrence Maslin, is the opening verse, which ties it all back to the Puritans.
We have something called the First Amendment that says that we can say whatever we want and implicitly we can do most of what we want. And yet there's this Puritan streak in America which says, oh, you can't change, you can't do that. That offends me.
The character singing the song is ambivalent about slipping standards, but Porter himself didn't feel that way.
I think what Cole Porter says is you better accept the fact that anything's going to go because that's what America's about, and you might as well enjoy the ride because American society is not going to stop for you, and it's not going to go backwards.
If it were serious, if it was really saying, oh, things are changing and we got to stop it, then it wouldn't hold up. You know, the mere fact that the camp element is there is the very thing that allows the lyric to be timeless.
Will Friedwald is an expert on the Great American Songbook, but in 1934, there was no Great American Songbook. The shelf life of a Broadway tune was short. By the 1950s, Anything Goes was a relic. And by coincidence, so was Frank Sinatra. It's hard to remember now, but Frankie used to be a teenage heartthrob. When the screaming girls in Bobby socks outgrew him, he was all washed up. In 1953, Sinatra reinvented his career and popular music itself with a series of albums that made Cole Porter and other songwriters from that era sound fresh again.
Sinatra is really the one who says, that these songs are classics, and this is what America has brought to the world. This is one of our great gifts to world culture, and that these songs deserve to be preserved and revered the same way that Bach is revered, the same way that Beethoven is revered.
The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, when most guys today that women prize today are just silly gigolos.
Sinatra's Anything Goes was so popular, it led to a TV broadcast of the show starring him and Ethel Merman. Paramount remade the movie in 1956, and a few years later, Anything Goes was back on Broadway.
Anything goes.
When you hear somebody say, such and such a song was neglected, or such and such a song is rare, or underdone, generally, the unspoken criteria of a song being underdone means that it was never done by Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald.
So though I'm not a great romancer, I know that I'm bound to answer when you propose.
Anything Goes sort of worked for the atomic cocktail age. But the lyrics about Mae West and the Vanderbilts had to go. Even the lines about fast cars and short skirts are starting to feel quaint. Now, if you hear Anything Goes, it's part of a retro Rat Pack album with Michael Bublé or Harry Connick Jr. We've lost that sense of danger, the titillation that audiences felt back in 1934. What would Anything Goes sound like if it were written today?
Hi, Joe.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Joe Keenan has written for TV shows like Frasier and Desperate Housewives. He's also a songwriter. He creates these great parodies of Cole Porter songs as a favor for charity events.
It takes a certain talent to, you know, to ape Porter songs, but it took genius to come up with the template in the first place.
So we gave Joe the task of updating Anything Goes. A reboot, as they say in Hollywood.
I thought, well, what's the way in? I could just write, you know, updated stanzas, but do a lot of updated stuff seemed to me to lack a point of view, and I thought it would be more interesting to approach the song by saying, you know, if Porter wrote that song today, what would be Porter's take, and what would he find a little bit shocking? And that wasn't an easy question to answer, because Porter was such a sophisticate that, you know, very little would have surprised him.
But when Joe started brainstorming, he found plenty of stuff. One generation's idea of slipping standards is another generation's idea of liberation from social constraints. And that's the story of America. So, here is Joe Keenan's update of Anything Goes, sung by his good friend Brian Batt, who played the character Sal Romano on Mad Men. A quick word of warning. These lyrics are not G-rated. So if there are kids listening, heads up, because anything goes.
Times have changed. Porter's ditty was once risque. But if Porter could see today, and decorum's complete decay, he would say, though the 30s were hot as hell, everything that went then still goes, and a whole lot else as well. When gays can wed and jaws aren't dropping, when Barney and Ben go shopping for baby clothes, anything goes. When dames as dim as Kim Kardashian triumph by acting trashy in tawdry shows, anything goes. The smut you can get today on the net today, straight or gay today and all day today, 'cause burlesque today is on your desk today, where nobody can oppose. When girls of 10 are adolescing and proving the fact by dressing like tiny hoes, anything goes. When grandma's face is pulled so tightly she looks like a Keira Knightley whose eyes won't close, anything goes. When stars whose thoughts are far from clever are tweeting their fans whenever they blow their nose, anything goes. If airing your views you like on Fox News you like, if tattoos you like or girl shoes you like, if rendezvous you like with Tom Cruise you like, just say you won't disclose. When Cary Grants and Spencer Tracys have turned into Kevin Spaceys and Russell Crowes, anything goes. When fast food chains serve fries with bacon to folks who could be mistaken for buffaloes, anything goes. when half the nation's filled with rancor from living in homes their banker will soon foreclose. Anything goes. Though banks are all crooks today with cooked books today, when they fail today, they get bailed today. And those banks today are saying thanks today as their bonus pool just grows. When men of God who preach with thunder are looking for fun with underage Romeos. Anything goes. Anything, anything. Ooh, everything.
That was the Studio 360 reboot of Cole Porter's Anything Goes, written by Joe Keenan. Brian Batt performed it with Jesse Reeks on piano. You can find the lyrics and download the song if you want at studio360.org. And Studio 360's Eric Malinsky produced our story. The new American Icon season continues through the fall. We'll be bringing you 9 new icons in all, and we want you to pick the 10th. What novel or movie, song, play, building, or other piece of American culture do you think deserves the spotlight? Visit studio360.org/American Icons and click on the map to let us know. Coming up, the world-class Los Angeles band Haim, who take the best parts of power pop from the 70s and 80s and combine those with the best parts of contemporary R&B and hip-hop.
I also don't really think genres really are a thing anymore. I think that, you know, every band is kind of drawing from different aspects of music, and I think that's what makes music exciting now.
In just a minute, Haim plays for us here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Approximately every third kid in America dreams of being a rock star, but mostly they want to be anointed without putting in the work. Then there's the band Haim. 3 sisters, Danielle, Esty, and Alana, who have been at it since they were grade schoolers. For a decade or so, they were in a cover band with their parents, followed by a brief foray into major label teen pop. And then, 6 years ago, when all 3 were just barely adults, they decided that big, arena-ready power pop was the way to go. Turns out, they were right. After opening on the road for acts like Mumford & Sons and Rihanna, Haim is now really blowing up, and they haven't even released an album yet. Days Are Gone, the band's first full-length record, comes out later this month, and they are all of them here with me now. Haim, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi.
First of all, Happy New Year.
Shana Tova.
And thanks for celebrating with us here
Thank
in New
you.
York. When you were children, as I said, you played in a band with your parents, playing covers at church functions and street fairs and stuff. And this band was called Rockenheim?
Yep. No G.
Did your parents' musical tastes rub off on you? Did they, I mean, given that you were doing this together?
Well, they were kind of the captain and the skipper of the band, to be honest. They, you know, it was songs that they grew up listening to that they wanted to play. I mean, I think when I was 13 or 14, I brought like a TLC song to the table, and that was, you know, the kibosh was put on that one.
What's the hip hop?
Yeah. You know, it was the songs that we listened to, you know, yeah. But for that band, it was like, you know, we played songs that, you know, my mom and dad grew up listening to. So my dad really loves funk music and Latin music. And so it was a lot of like Earth, Wind & Fire and Santana. And then on my mom's side, she was really into like Joni Mitchell and Tina Turner. So we did.
Bonnie Raitt.
And Bonnie Raitt. So
they were people of their generation.
Exactly.
And is it true your mother was actually on both Let's Make a Deal and The Gong Show?
Oh, yes. You've done your homework.
My mom and dad were on Let's Make a Deal. They went
really?
As a married
bride and groom
because they needed money to go on their honeymoon.
I am seeing it. I mean, the biopic is going to be incredible.
It's going to be amazing.
I know.
It's like a reality show about Southern California. And in the biopic, who do you want to play you?
Oh gosh. Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
Can
Meryl Streep
play three of us, all three of us?
So set in 2064 or something?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So it seems like, reading about you and your fascinating backstory, your Partridge Family backstory, it seems like this has been the plan from day one. Is the rock star dream as billed? Is it as good as you imagined?
I think we're just having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I think that we've been able to see the world together and have a lot of fun together. And I think that's pretty much just been the best part. We kind of, almost as an accident, started writing songs together, which we'd never done before. We'd written songs on our own. And I think just kind of as a challenge to ourselves, we tried to write a song together. And, you know, we did. And we had so much fun doing it that we just kept doing it, and we did that for about 5 years, playing, you know, opening for all of our friends.
It seems to me, being in a band with one's siblings, that must make it lots easier.
It does make it easier. It makes songwriting also very easy.
Because of all the shorthand that exists after 20
Basically,
years?
Basically, I mean, there's definitely a weird sisterly ESP that we have.
Sometimes we finish each other's sandwiches.
Weird.
Can you play a song and then we can talk some more?
We can't play music.
What are you,
we don't know
what,
how.
What are you going to play? Which of your songs are you going to play?
I think we're going to play a song called Forever.
Remember me, I remember love, I remember trying to stay to get the bad time. You took it all, and you tried to see, and you tried to bring yourself up with that involving me. It isn't bad, but to have your way, to try to get up and go, and I get you see. It's bad, but to have your way, but I'm trying to get you with the you to know that. Hey, you, can't you make the same? I know, but you ain't the one to play the game. That I know, and I'm never gonna go your way. If you go, well now I know. Whoever tried to make it right, but take it away something and said no. I'm tired of fighting the good fight. If you say the word, then I'll say goodbye. But forever I see you and me, forever I'll care for you. And I never believed in their insights, just another good reason to get right. I don't wanna turn around, so come on baby, come on and try to let it out. Let it go, we're still the same, so come on baby, trigger the sound, let's figure it out. Let's get back to where we started out. Hey, you, can't you make the same? You ain't the one to play the game. Now I know, and I'm never gonna go your way. If you go, well now I know. Forever a chair to make it right, but together is something and say no. I'm tired of fighting the good fight. If you say the word, then I'll say goodbye. Forever I see you and me, forever I'll cheer for you. And no, I never believe in their insights, just another good reason to get right. Have the energy, yeah.
I'm tired of fighting the good fight. If you see the word, then I'll say goodbye. But forever I'll see you and me. Forever I'll cheer for you. And I know I never believed in there inside. It's just another good reason to get right. Forever cheer to make it right. Particularly soft and inside. I'm tired of fighting the good fight. If you see the word, then I'll say goodbye. But forever I'll see you and me. Forever I'll cheer for you. And I know I never believed in there inside. It's just another good reason to get right. Forever we change. Forever we change. Forever we change. Forever we change. Forever we change.
That was Forever by Haim, Danielle and Alana, and SD Haim on guitars and keyboard and bass, and Dash Hutton on drums. You have opened for some very big bands like Mumford & Sons and Rihanna. What is it like being this sort of different genre opener for these big stars?
Everyone's been really nice. I mean, it's you would think that it'd be kind of confusing, but we've never been around a crowd that didn't show us love, which is really nice. I think a lot of people now are thirsty for something new and want to hear different things.
I also don't really think genres really are a thing anymore. I think that, you know, every band is kind of drawing from different aspects of music, and I think that's what makes music exciting now.
When people write about you guys and your music, they always talk about, oh, it's all their music is this homage to 70s pop. But as I listen to this record, which I very much like, it seems equally influenced by contemporary R&B, hip-hoppy bits. Might you eventually lean more on the kind of R&B hip-hop influences than this 70s, 80s thing that every article about you mentioned?
I mean, I think that we're equally... I mean, we just listen to everything. We don't kind of discriminate again. I mean, we just, you know, growing up, we listened to Top 40 and oldie stations, and we just grew up listening to the radio, honestly. And in L.A., there's a lot of variety, you know, really good West Coast hip-hop and all the different kind of music has somehow crept into our minds, and we kind of regurgitate it.
Yeah.
It is like you were created in a lab. Here you are, and as our listeners can see, you're funny, your music is danceable and up-tempo. Most, if not all, of your lyrics are about heartbreak and loss and the melancholy passage of time. Mm-hmm. Well, how come?
I think it's more just about, you know, we write songs from our own experience, but we also write songs about our friends' experiences, and they're not all necessarily autobiographical. So we really love walking down memory lane and reminiscing about things. We really enjoy doing that.
I mean, are the boy problems multiplying? Because now, I mean, you know, you can probably get anybody.
Oh, gosh. Oh, wow. What are you saying over there? No. We're too busy for anything.
We work hard, but we play equally as hard. So we're having a good time on the road, too.
And for instance, I read, SD, on the road in the United Kingdom, you gave your number to a kid, a boy in the audience.
I did. Yeah. I really wanted this picture that he took. And I didn't realize at the time, I knew it was being videotaped, but I didn't know that it was going to be able to be replayed.
With your actual phone number.
With my actual phone number. And the thing is, the sad part about that story is that he never texted me. But the good part of the story is now I get texts and phone calls from people all around the world, and I get to talk to people.
That's a good thing?
It's amazing. I love it. You know, when we get to each city, we have people that we can hang out with and can tell us where to go eat and, you know, all the good stuff to do in each respective city.
No wonder you're upbeat. upbeatness comes to those who are upbeat. Thank you so much for being here. And aren't you happy that I did not mention Stevie Nicks in the course of this entire conversation?
Look at you.
I'm proud of myself.
I'm very proud of you.
Haim, I love you, and thank you for coming in. Will you play
some
more?
I love you, too.
Sure. Can you play one more song before you go?
Yes.
Yeah, I think we're going to actually do a cover.
A Fleetwood Mac cover.
Yeah, a Fleetwood Mac cover. But pre-Stevie, pre-Lindsay, Peter Green era, bluesy vibes. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can download Haim's cover of Fleetwood Mac's Oh Well at studio360.org. Their debut album, Days Are Gone, comes out later this month. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Mark Sheely,
Dylan Piers McCoy,
Felicity Sheehy.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Can't help about the shape I'm in. I can't sing, I ain't pretty, and my legs are thin. But don't ask me what I think of you. I might not give the answer that you want me to.
And do not forget about your American icons. We want to know which classic piece of American culture you'd like us to deconstruct. Nominate a novel, a TV show, a movie, a play, a building, an object, a piece of music, any of it, at studio360.org/American Icons.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works. Studio 360's American Icons project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Nurse Ratched speaks out.
How many people in positions of power feel that they know best?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is our next episode of Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.